The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2022 Walter Magazine. With a nod towards Halloween, we begin with an article originally published in June 2021 called Fairylands by John Hood. That rock in the river was a big one, big enough to sit on. That's what the woman did, in fact, while her husband spent the afternoon fishing upstream. She waded out to the rock, found a comfortable seat, and took out a book to read. What happened next was like something out of a book, but not the one she was reading. Hearing footsteps and voices, the woman glanced up and saw two boys cavorting along a trail, their distracted father trudging along behind. As the boys approached the water's edge, something else entered her field of vision. It started coming up the river, she later recalled. What was it? Quote, a pale-skinned, waterlogged-looking creature with black hair and sharp, serrated teeth showing in a smile, end quote. Paying no attention to the woman perched on the rock, it focused on the boys and moved rapidly through the water toward them. She wasn't the only one who saw it. The boys did, too. They picked up sticks and pointed them at the mysterious swimmer. Although apparently unable to see the creature that was now just a few feet away from his boys, the father nevertheless decided they were playing too close to the water and ushered them back to the trail. Maybe you think you know what was really in that river, a bullfrog, a bottom feeder, a bumpy log converted into something sinister by an overactive imagination. But the woman in question is convinced she saw a fairy just a few years ago, right here in North Carolina. It's not our state's first fairy sighting. Oh, it's easy to scoff at those who claim to see wee folk wading in rivers or dancing on hilltops. How childish, how backward. But I bet you know someone who still carries a lucky charm or wears their lucky sweatshirt whenever the wolf pack play the Tar Heels. And I bet you know someone who watches Ancient Aliens or Ghost Hunters. Generations ago, people thought universal schooling would disabuse the masses of such fanciful superstitions. They thought the relentless march of science would muscle old faiths and folk traditions aside, converting them into historical curiosities. Rationalization and intellectualization, the sociologist Max Weber famously predicted a century ago, would bring the disenchantment of the world. The magical, the paranormal, the supernatural are not so easily banished. According to a recent Harris poll, 42% of us believe in ghosts, 36% in UFOs, 29% in astrology, and 26% in witches. Fairies, by which I mean the broad swath of legendary little people, rarely get included in American polls. But surveys in other countries find significant minorities still believe in fairies. In some places, such as Iceland, believers form a majority. Among the believers is the woman I mentioned earlier. I wish I could tell you more about her and the fairy encounter she claimed to witness from that big rock. Unfortunately, I can't even tell you her name. Anonymity was the promise made by folklorist Simon Young in 2014 when he began soliciting first-person accounts of fairy sightings. Published 4 years later as The Fairy Census, Young's research spans hundreds of stories from around the world, including several from our state. While researching my historical fantasy novel, Mountain Folk, largely set in North Carolina during the American Revolution, I learned a great deal about the fairy lore of our ancestors. Some of it developed locally, tied to specific Carolina landmarks. Other beliefs were brought here from afar, from the British Isles and Northern Europe to the Mediterranean and West Africa. It turns out that almost all cultures have stories of wee folk. Accounts vary, of course, but a surprising number of them converge in key details. Creatures 2 to 3 feet tall, infused with magic, and attuned to nature. The original inhabitants of North Carolina often told tales of such creatures. Among the Cherokee, for example, they were called the Yuni Aminihi, or water dwellers, and had the power to boost fish catches and promote healing. In one story, a water dweller disguises herself as human to attend a dance. Smitten by her charms, a Cherokee man follows her to a riverbank and professes his love. He must be persuasive, for she agrees to become his wife. Eyes sparkling, she dives in the river and beckons him to follow. "It's really only a road," she says. He takes a deep breath and leaps. Finding a wondrous world hidden beneath the river, he lives there happily as her husband. Later, when he leaves to visit his parents, they turn out to be long since dead. Generations of Cherokee live and die during the few years he lives among the water dwellers. Rivers are hardly North Carolina's only sites for fairy lore. Another folk from Cherokee legend, the Nunahi, are associated with such locations as Pilot Mountain and the modern town of Franklin, where the Nunahi were said to have helped defeat a Creek invasion and, much later, a raid by Union soldiers. Moreover, as the fairy census reminds us, our sightings aren't limited to old tales preserved in old books. They still happen. In the book, another North Carolinian described an encounter she had in her youth with a fairy about 2 to 3 feet tall, dressed entirely in red, with a solid red face, tiny white horns on the top of his head, and a red pointed tail. He was standing next to the stump of a tree, which he said had been his home until it was felled during the construction of the girl's house. She ran to get her parents, but they couldn't see him. The more you study both folklore and modern-day sightings, the more you come to appreciate the commonalities, such as the extreme time difference between fairy realms and the human world, and the link between fairies and nature. There are many explanations for fairy belief. For some, it's reassuring to believe that good and bad events aren't just random. For others, fairy belief is about rediscovering a sense of wonder. That's how some of your fellow North Carolinians feel, anyway. Whether out exploring their state's natural beauty or just puttering around the neighborhood, they keep their minds open along with their eyes. They suspend their disbelief. They dare to hope that something utterly fantastic will happen, that something utterly fantastic can happen. After all, it's happened before, or so they've heard. This article was edited for Time. From the Vault, Country Crooners, an exhibit at the History Museum highlights female musicians by Hampton Williams Hoffer. Country music's not all about blue jeans, flannel, and big belt buckles. We've got Dolly Parton's custom butterfly inlaid Gibson banjo, Emmylou Harris's white floral boots, and Wanda Jackson's pink fringed blazer to prove it. Starting on October 28th, The Power of Women in Country Music, an exhibition on loan from the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, will make its temporary home at the North Carolina Museum of History. This comprehensive exhibition tells the stories of some 70 trailblazing female country artists who've left their marks on the genre over the past century. And it'll be right at home here, where the NCMH has layered in special artifacts from several of North Carolina's own pioneering women in country music. The exhibition is a record of artists who paved the way for the ones to come. I think visitors will find out amazing details about the artists they love, and also about the artists who those artists love, said Kelsey Geltz, associate curator at the Grammy Museum in L.A. Maybe you love Miranda Lambert, but did you know that she was inspired by Maybelle Carter's unique way of strumming the guitar? Female performers have also used their platforms to bring social issues to the forefront. Dolly Parton's singing about working 9 to 5 sounded lighthearted and catchy, but offered progressive lyrics for the time. Mickey Guyton's 2020 hit, Black Like Me, confronted racism in a push for more diversity in country music. With photos, handwritten lyrics, and instruments, the power of women in country music celebrates not only the legendary groundbreakers, but also current stars like Miranda Morris and Brandi Carlile. Every item in the collection is on loan, and many of the women who own them have visited the exhibit. It comes alive when they stop by, Gelt says of the stars. Many have cried to see their artifacts on display. There's the white dress that Leanne Rimes wore to the Grammys when, at just 14, she became the youngest artist and first country artist to win for Best New Artist. Wanda Jackson is considered one of the first female country stars. She toured with Elvis in the 1950s. Her acoustic guitar, which came from a female-owned guitar company, now sits on display, pink and proud. There's also Taylor Swift's Deering banjo from her 2010 music video for Mean, and Faith Hill's 2002 Grammy for Best Female Country Vocal Performance, and Reba McEntire's pink dressing gown from the music video for her 1993 hit, Does He Love You? Featured in the exhibit is Aunt Samantha Bumgarner from the Dillsboro area, who's considered one of the first women to ever record a country song in 1924. The museum also curates artifacts from North Carolina musicians like Myrtle Cooper Wiseman from Boone, Donna Fargo from Mount Airy, Rhiannon Giddens from Greensboro, and Casey Tyndall from Greenville. Durham country star Reese Palmer contributed the microphone she used to record her first episode of Color Me Country, a radio show focused on the underrepresented stories in the genre. It's an honor to be included in the company of so many women I admire, says Palmer. The microphone shows that the story of country music is way more diverse and complex than meets the eye. There's a strong line of women of color who've made it possible for me to stand here today, and I'm representing them as well as those that come after. Female artists make up only 10% of country radio airplay, but won more than half of the Grammys Country Music Albums of the Year over the last 20 years. We wanted to shed a light on how important women are to country music, Gelt says. They're the ones moving it forward. Katie Edwards, the curator of popular culture at the NCMH, grew up listening to her grandmother's cassettes of Dolly Parton, who's still one of her idols. For Edwards, the exhibit's impending arrival is a thrill. There are so many great artifacts in this exhibition that helped shape the narrative of women in country music, says Edwards. For years, women have received less airtime on country music radio stations, fewer opportunities for touring, and just have been underrepresented. Palmer is one of the artists who will be featured in the NCMH's musical accompaniment to the exhibition, a concert series called Southern Songbirds, which will take place in the museum's Daniels Auditorium, emceed by legendary North Carolina singer-songwriter Jim Lauderdale. I think a lot of people have a particular image of what country music performers look like or where they come from. This series further breaks the mold that's being broken down daily in the industry, says Carol Leinfelder, creative director at the NCMH. We're incredibly lucky, from a regional standpoint, to live in the part of the country where we can say, this is ours, because it is. She spearheaded the Southern Songbird series, which will welcome Charlie Lowry, Caitlin Carey, H.C. McIntyre, and Tift Merritt. All these artists have a strong sense of consciousness in their art, says Palmer, who's also performing. I'm proud to say that they and I are from North Carolina. Growing up in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, Leinfelder was surrounded by roots music and country, most often performed by men. When female artists started to take center stage and dominate the industry, I was thrilled. It was empowering, says Leinfelder. Now, in 2022, it's more than that. Country music really branches across so many communities, and North Carolina has a deep canon of artists contributing to where it's been and where it's going. This article was edited for Time. From the Nature Department, the pumpkin spider. These festive arachnids are most often spotted leading up to Halloween, by Mike Dunn. It seems our desire for holiday decorations now begins well before the actual events, so it should have come as no surprise when I saw the first spooky Halloween yard ornaments while August still showed on my calendar. Scattered among the skeletons, werewolves, ghosts, and witches, you can always find a large assortment of exaggerated caricatures of one of my favorite groups of local wildlife, spiders. In my many years of teacher workshops across our state, I've encountered quite a few people that rank spiders high on their list of fears, along with snakes and bats. Is it a coincidence that they're also popular as spooky decor? But as with many things in our lives, the more you know about something, the more likely you are to appreciate it. One memory of changing opinions on spiders really stands out. It was my first year of doing an intensive program that involved multiple visits per year to schools across the state, taking the teachers outdoors to see how they could utilize nature on their school grounds in their lessons. At our last session at 1K through 12 school on the coast, we were going around the room sharing what we'd learned during the course of the program. The physical education teacher had attended all the sessions, sitting quietly, almost sullenly, through most. Legs crossed, arms crossed, you know the pose. It was tough for me to tell what he might have gotten out of it. When it came his turn to speak, he stood up. Before this program, any time I saw a bug or a spider in my gym, I would squish it, he said, loudly stomping his foot on the floor. Now, after learning about them, I get a cup, catch them, and release them outside. Then he sat down. I guess that was a win for both the museum and the spiders. While many people seem to fear spiders, few species cause us any harm. Many are exquisitely beautiful, and all play an important role in our ecosystem. They're beneficial predators that help keep our populations of many insect pests in check. and they're also an important food source for many birds and small animals. About this time every year, I run into, sometimes literally, one of my favorite spiders, the striking marbled orb weaver. This widespread beauty is usually seen in late summer and fall throughout the United States and in much of Europe. Females are 2 to 3 times larger than males, and they're the ones we usually encounter. The back of the marbled orb weaver is spectacular, a bright yellow background with a ghoulish dark pattern that resembles marbling, hence the common name. They can vary in color, but I've read that they tend to turn darker with age and often appear more orange than yellow, just in time for our pumpkin spiced holiday. Prior to laying eggs, usually in late October, females have a large globular abdomen that gives rise to another name you may see, pumpkin spider. Underneath, they're less striking, but colorful nonetheless. You can also appreciate the black bands on the legs a bit better when not distracted by the bright colors of their topside. The species generally has a hiding place just off to the side of her web, usually in a curled leaf. She keeps up with the goings-on in her web by means of a connecting strand of silk that acts as a vibrating alarm when something hits her woven trap. When an insect is caught, she'll run out and engage it, wrapping it in silk and injecting venom, which will subdue the prey and set the stage for her dining pleasure. Don't worry, they're not considered dangerous to us, but it does make me wonder if flies come in pumpkin spice flavor. In spite of their association with spooky themes like this special holiday, I find these spiders aren't scary at all. They're a particularly beautiful and welcome addition to our woods. From the music department, Sound Scenes, Jason Graves composes musical tracks for high-profile games by David Menconi. Even though he's never had anything like a radio hit, it's very possible that Jason Graves stands as North Carolina's most heard musician over the past few decades. He's one of the busiest game soundtrack composers in the business, with Tomb Raider, Fortnite, Moss, and Dead Space among his high-profile credits. It's not just the millions of copies these games sell. It's also the fact that people play them over and over for hours, days, and weeks at a time. Sometimes these soundtracks involve full-on symphony orchestras, but the majority of them are one-man band projects that Graves writes and records out of his home studio, located on a 30-acre spread near Benson. He has a mad scientist approach to the sound of music, in which he spends a lot of time banging on things in search of just the right effect. I'm a percussionist at heart, so I'm always finding things and turning them into instruments to make noise, Graves says. Now 49 years old, Graves grew up in Raleigh with an early interest in pursuing music before going off to college, earning degrees at Appalachian State University and the University of Southern California. Film scoring was always a passion of his, especially after he studied with soundtrack legends Jerry Goldsmith and Elmer Bernstein, who were responsible for such films as Patton, Chinatown, and The Ten Commandments. Graves stayed in L.A. for 5 years after graduate school, playing sessions anywhere and anywhere, everywhere he could, before coming back to North Carolina in the late 1990s. Along with playing drums in local bands, including Slackmates and Milagro Saints, Graves did studio session work on commercials and videos. That eventually led to composing computer game soundtracks, first in collaboration with Rod Abernethy, and then at his own home studio in Raleigh's Boylan Heights neighborhood, before moving out to Benson about 7 years ago. Most of Graves' early credits were softer fare, game spin-offs from children's shows like Curious George and Dora the Explorer. That changed with 2008's Dead Space, which put Graves on the map by winning a British Academy Film Award, the UK equivalent of the Academy Awards in America. As dread-inducing as the dystopian horror game it accompanies, Graves' score established him as a go-to for frightening sonic vibes. His recent work on the fantasy adventure series Moss is almost the polar opposite, soft and gentle. In a way, Jason is a mysterious black box that needs very little input, says Stephen Hood, audio director at Moss, game producer Polyarch. We'll send him some gameplay videos, talk a little about context, and he just kind of does it, creates this beautiful, mysterious, emotional palette. Once he's finished with the game's score, Graves rarely plays the game himself, partly because he's not great at it, but partly because he finds the composing part of it to be more fun. He maintains a regular 9-to-5 workday schedule during the week, with evenings and weekends off for family time and recharging. Nevertheless, the internal compositional wheels are always turning. I'm like a kid in a candy store, except I actually get paid to pig out on the candy, he laughs. This article was edited for Time. From this month's calendar, on October 28th, pumpkins will set sail at twilight. Carved by community members and accompanied by local musicians, dozens of jack-o'-lanterns sit atop trains of floats as kayakers row them across Cary's Bond Park Lake. To add a pumpkin to the parade, carve one up and drop it off at the Bond Park Boathouse on October 27th. The evening also includes snacks and family-friendly Halloween activities. The event is free. Visit townofcary.org for more information. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.